Protests over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis have sparked a nationwide movement, with calls to defund or reform police departments and confront a history of systemic racism. In Vermont, recent demonstrations have built momentum for community and statewide discussions on issues of race and policing. I'm Lydia Brown. Today, we're listening back to a community conversation recorded Thursday, June 18th, in collaboration with Vermont PBS. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld and Tracy Griffith of St. Michael's College led the discussion over Zoom with panelists Susanna Davis, Executive Director of Racial Equity for Vermont, John Murad, Acting Chief of Police for the Burlington Police Department, Ali Jang, Burlington City Councilor for Ward 7, Mia Schultz, a Bennington resident who serves as Vice Chair of the Bennington Town Democratic Party and as a member of the Vermont Ethnic Studies Coalition, Mark Anderson, Sheriff for Windham County and a representative of the Vermont Sheriff's Association, and Stephanie Seguino, Professor of Economics at the University of Vermont. To start the discussion, here's host Tracy Griffith leading us off with definitions of systemic racism and implicit bias.
Let's first consider implicit bias. It refers to attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, our actions, our decisions, and obviously in an unconscious manner. So these are unconscious thoughts and feelings, and they can influence our behavior in ways that we're not even aware of. Now, in terms of systemic racism, systems and structures that have procedures or processes that disadvantage people of color. Structural racism prevents or makes it more challenging for people of color to participate equally in society. African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans are disproportionately affected through every stage of the criminal justice system, despite the evidence that different racial and ethnic groups commit crimes at roughly the same rates. And we're going to be exploring some of that this evening.
Thank you for the backdrop, Professor Griffith. Let's turn to one of our panelists, Director of Racial Equity, Susanna Davis. It's been almost a year to the day since you were appointed as Vermont's first ever Director of Racial Equity. Since then, you've been assessing racial equity determinants across the whole of state government. What have you learned about the prevalence of racial disparities and systemic racism in the law enforcement sector specifically?
Thank you for the question. Thank you for having me. Hello, buenas noches, everybody. What I've learned in these last 10 or so months is that systemic racism in Vermont looks a lot like systemic racism in other parts of the country, and that so many people don't recognize that it exists here. One of the things that I've heard perhaps most often in my time here is, well, how can we have a racism problem when there are barely people of color in Vermont? And really, that in itself is a huge indicator of the problem, right? So part of the tricky thing with systemic racism is getting people to understand the insidious ways that it pops up into our lives. In years past, it was obvious, it was clear, there were signs that said whites and colored. There were very obvious physical separations and very clear legal language that told us that racism was explicit. But racism and systemic racism has moved from the visible to the invisible sphere. And so it's often really difficult to help people understand that it still exists and that it still impacts us today. And so that's perhaps one of the things that I've seen here in Vermont is that there's a broad lack of awareness of the ways that systemic inequity operates even here.
Okay, maybe we can move on to Ali. You've identified racial profiling as an issue in Burlington. So how is this problem manifested for your constituents?
Thank you. First, I would like to thank you for having us. And I think before responding to that question, it would be imperative to thank all the Burlingtonians that have shown up to public forum to express their frustration, their ideas about what is happening. And it will be important also to point out that it did not happen when George Floyd was killed in the hands of the police. So systemic racism does exist here in Vermont. And the way it plays out is many different forms. you know, the arrest data, for example, that Stephanie Seguni worked on. We can talk about also the incarceration rate that here in Vermont. And so the lack of opportunities for Black and Brown people in this community. We live it, we experience it every single day. And I think it is imperative for everyone, if you wanna see change, to rally behind the people that are truly affected, listen to them and try to bring change that is needed to move us forward.
So this is something you're hearing, Ali, from your constituents as a real problem that they're facing in the city?
Absolutely. And I think it will be imperative also. I'm a Black elected official and my constituents are not only white Black people or people of color, they are white people. But I think what we've been hearing lately, it is the needed change, the cry for anger. People are so angry, people are so fed up, and people need justice. And I think that's what we've been hearing lately since George Floyd has been.
Chief John Murad, Councillor Jang referenced the extraordinary number of people that have been turning out, not just to city council meetings, but to other city department meetings, to call for real dramatic change in the Burlington City Police Department. Susana Davis and Ali Jang have helped sort of define the problem that exists. You've heard from a lot of constituents in Burlington about what they want to see. I wonder, what do you think needs to change in not just Burlington City Police Department, but departments across the state to address the issues that people are raising right now?
Well, I think one thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that we are looking at our data. Burlington has been pretty proactive about that. In November of last year, we released a report on use of force that included confronting the disparate ways in which race plays a role in police use of force. I think the overall record there was a positive one for use of force in general, but the racial disparities are real. That confronted two disparities in that report, mentioned disparities in arrests as well. We did in August of last year, late July of last year, a long study on traffic. It was a follow-up to a previous traffic study that actually showed some really good results with regard to establishing parity for traffic stops and working away from some of the numbers that we've been seeing. But you can't make those kinds of changes unless you know where you are. I think, you know, one of the most important things, for example, of the fact that this is a census year is that the census allows us to say, you know, here we are and these are our numbers. And I think that that's true too of any of these kinds of issues, for race especially, but also for other kinds of policing issues that have to do with how we serve our neighbors, the ways in which we serve them, the kinds of jobs that we do. And I think that certainly the cries for change are not falling on deaf ears here in Burlington. I think that there are real risks to some of those things. And I think we need to examine change in ways that are driven by the data that I'm talking about, that kind of collection, that kind of analysis, so that you can actually make impactful changes that are felt in the community.
You know, we've been looking at this data for years now, right? And I think everyone that's looked at it can agree that it gives rise to concern about the prevalence of racial disparities in law enforcement. Beyond looking at the data, do you have any proposals for actual operational reforms that are going to get to the core of the issue that the data illuminates?
Well, I think that what you do with that data is you start to say, where are these contacts coming from? Where are they disparate? We've actually found that having officers in the school is a tremendously helpful way to have those kinds of relationships change. I know that that's not the case in other parts of the country. I know that there is a cry for changing that. But the fact of the matter is that in Burlington, having officers in the schools allows us to connect with communities, especially communities of color, especially new American communities of color, in early ways that are beneficial and that really forestall for enforcement down the road. Officers who are schooled in the dynamics of the kids with whom they interact who are really cognizant of relationships in those schools, are able to make decisions that are very different than an officer responding as a patrol officer is going to make when confronted with a situation that is really only the situation immediately in front of him or her and is taking action based only on that. So those deeper relationships are tremendously important. I think that if you prioritize community affairs, if you prioritize roles that have that level of engagement, whether it's an SRO, whether it's other kinds of roles, you work very hard to make certain that you're connecting with the parts of your community that matter. I myself, have a good relationship with people at AALV in Burlington. I have been accompanied by them and gone with them to people's homes to talk with parents about kids who may be on the cusp of problems, parents who are uncertain about where to go next to deal with their kids. Those kinds of relationships are tremendously important. And that's, I think, where you really can operationalize some of these changes.
Mia, so Chief Murad has talked about data-driven analysis, right? And also talked about school resource officers and maybe possible changes in those kinds, looking at the data to make changes in those kinds of areas and the benefit of school resource officers. Can you talk to those issues a little bit? And then one thing that has not yet been mentioned was something that we've been hearing a lot around the country and in national news is defunding the police. What do you think about that?
Wow. Well, that's a big question. Let me first introduce myself. Thank you so much for having me here with all these really great panelists. Here in Bennington, and I just want to preface that, I appreciate being included in this conversation because as folks in the south of Vermont often get overlooked in these conversations. So I do appreciate that. In terms of the schools and SROs, I actually feel that that's not the case here in Bennington. I do have teachers who have reported to me disparities between treatment and of African-American and BIPOC kids in terms of discipline and attention to those police, to those children. And that is not in alignment with those of the white children. So that's a different perspective that I'm hearing. It's interesting to hear Chief Murad say that. Furthermore, the kids so we have like different lenses when it comes to police as well. We're coming from a place of trauma, daily trauma, including the events that bring us to this panel right now. We're rewatching what we see police do, and our children are not immune to that. When they see an armed officer in the school, and they are armed, as far as I know, in the schools, it is not creating a space of communication or community in my eyes and my children's eyes. In terms of where do we go with police? And defunding, yeah, I think that's absolutely an option for us. We need to heal and build our communities, and right now we're destroying them. We're destroying them with violence, and we see that all across the nation. And instead of using those funds to fund police with armory and military weapons and that sort of thing, we absolutely should think about therapy and social services and healing people instead of targeting. I just want to say one other thing in terms of data. Here in Bennington, data is sparse. Like, we have statewide data, Bennington Police Department here has only recently been called to action to collect data. But what data we do have is disturbing, that black people are pulled over at 4.7 times the rate of white people. They are searched at 10.5% of the rate of versus 1.9% of white people. So that's just a snippet of data that we were able to, and so all we have to go off of is testimony. And that's the testimony of our community members, of our BIPOC members, who are accustomed to being pulled over just traveling to and from work, who are accustomed to being pulled up. I had a family who told me that they were pulled over 12, they had 12 tickets in 22 days. 12 tickets in 22 days. Now, you can't tell me that there is anything else but race that is attributing to that, because I've heard it time and time again. So it's time for a change. It's time for more than bias training that is just really centered in white supremacy. It's time to really relook and reform everything that we think about policing. And we also have to remember that where policing came from, right? Like, we know that part of policing came from slavery. And so why would we want to keep a system that is based in that? Why can't we think outside of the box? So that's how I feel about that.
From VPR, I'm Lydia Brown. Today, we're listening back to a community conversation recorded earlier this month in collaboration with Vermont PBS. The voice you just heard was Mia Schultz, a Bennington resident. She's also vice chair of the Bennington Town Democratic Party and a member of the Vermont Ethnic Studies Coalition. Schultz was one of several panelists who joined hosts Tracy Griffith and Peter Hirschfeld to talk about issues of race and policing. A quick note to our listeners, VPR did invite Bennington Police Chief Paul Doucette to participate in the discussion. He couldn't join us and didn't provide a statement in time for the live discussion, but since has reached out to say that members of the Bennington Police Department continue to work with all members of the Bennington community in a fair and impartial manner as we continue building positive relationships. Chief Doucette also says that the Bennington Police Department, along with numerous departments around the state of Vermont, was appalled at the actions and lack of actions by Minneapolis police officers. He says we have been supportive of peaceful protests here in Bennington and made sure protesters feel secure in their right to assembly and speech.
I want to bring Windham County Sheriff Mark Anderson in now. Sheriff, you heard Mia make the case for foundational and fundamental reforms to what policing looks like in this state and in this country, and talked about the disenfranchisement and marginalization of swaths of the community that do not feel like they are being protected and served by these institutions. Are you open to the concept of a real ground-up reconsideration of what public safety ought to look like and the way in which we allocate resources towards it?
Thank you, Peter. So to answer your question briefly, yes. In fact, these are conversations that even began a year ago, 2 years ago. And I'm not sure if everybody in this panel is familiar with what's been put forward as the 10 points of modernizing policing, but there's a lot of support from the chiefs, the sheriffs, and the Department of Public Safety towards modernizing policing. When we talk about it, we've discussed from a perspective that of Minneapolis versus what the ideal goal line is, we're somewhere in between in Vermont. We've done a lot of really progressive things. We've utilized a force continuum for many years. We've not permitted or we've classified chokeholds as a lethal use of force. We require report writing, extensive report writing on uses of force. We prioritize de-escalation on every level of training from the very beginning of law enforcement training. So we have done a lot, and I like to say that I'm proud of Vermont and what we have done, but I also recognize we haven't done enough. And so the portions of modernizing policing are an effort to recognize that there are issues of systemic racism. We need to identify how we are causing those, and we need to listen to the community. When I first started engaging and how do we, how does my agency respond to this? The more clear message I got was, we need to start listening and we need to stop talking. And so we actually, my agency is forming a council of community members in an effort to try and develop our, and review all of our policies and implement change. That is also an organization that's going to be part of our review of use of force incidents in an effort to try and bring community stakeholders into the conversation. We had that before, but we didn't have it in the same context. It was officials representing that group. And now we're trying to get grassroots people to join us and be able to help us be part of the conversation. We don't have an interest in hurting people. That's not our job. Our job is to try and stop bad situations from happening. Our job is to try and connect people with services. And our job is to help with a civil society. To do those things sometimes do require an appropriate use of force, but that's not what we choose to do. We would rather de-escalate. My agency likes to use what we call verbal judo. We'll spend the time to engage with an individual so that we can talk them down and gain voluntary compliance, as opposed to get into a knockdown dragout where we all go home hurt. So I think that there's a lot that we need to do. I'm proud that we've already done a lot and that we have a lot of perspectives in Vermont that have been good towards change, but we need to listen more.
That 10-point plan that you referenced, Sheriff Anderson, does not include an overall reduction in the number of law enforcement officers at any agency in the state. Is that an appropriate measure to consider? And do you think that public safety could fulfill its mission with fewer sworn law enforcement officers than it has right now?
So in referencing that, I'd like to make mention of a statistic regarding Minneapolis. Based on a report, they have approximately 16 police officers per square mile. In my county, we have approximately one police officer per 46 square miles. So when we talk about the defunding of police, the concern I have is that we were never really funded to do these things. Talking about the proactive work that we have done, in my county, we now have every agency that has a police social worker either embedded or accessible to every single agency in Windham County. The Bells Falls Police Department was one of the first police departments in the state to bring forward a police social worker. We're trying to engage mental health. My predecessor, Sheriff Keith Clark, he was one of the instructors for Act 80, which was the mandatory mental health reform for all law enforcement to receive. My agency has been very proactive and progressive in trying to recognize the various different people that we come into contact with. And we've been trying to share that that work and that skill with the state. Or all the agencies in the state. The reduction in police officers in a state that has in total 1,200 police officers at a full-time capacity, we really don't have the resources compared to Orlando, New York, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Phoenix. And so when we start talking about some of the terrible things that are happening, domestic violence, we're talking about sexual assaults, child abuse, we can talk about restorative justice. And in fact, we've also in my county have embraced a lot of restorative justice programs, but there's also times where restorative justice won't work. Generally speaking, we need to recognize that there are processes in place that need to be examined, but we also need to recognize that there's also ways that we can handle lower level issues through the restorative justice program rather than through the criminal justice system.
I'd like to kind of throw it back to Zuzana. You are tasked with addressing racial equity issues across the state, right? So what are some of your thoughts on reforms that, you know, where can, particularly as it relates to the area of policing, obviously, but after you've listened to some of the, you know, the ideas here, what are some of your thoughts?
There's a lot of talk right now about the difference between reform, defunding, abolishing. And one thing that I think is really important to recognize, and Mia, I think, said it very well, is that when you hear people calling for defunding or abolishing police, it is almost always paired with the concurrent and necessary action of investing those funds and resources into services that will help prevent people from getting caught up in the justice system in the first place. Okay. I'll give one example. It's like the saying says, right, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I'll give one example. I remember reading years ago that if we were to start building a prison today, because of the amount of time that it takes to go through permitting and everything else and construction and you name it, it won't be ready until today's 8-year-olds are of age to enter it. In other words, starting today to build a carcel facility, it's not going to be ready in time until today's 8-year-olds have already gone down a path where they would need it because they'd be open for business. Instead of investing it in after school programs, education outreach, college funds, mentor programs, nutrition programs, housing, all of the things that keep people stable and keep them away from criminality or recidivism, those are the things that tend to be focused on when you hear people calling for defunding or abolishing. So I'm just going to say that point because I think it's really important that we weigh every option that's on the table in a way that's fair and really understanding them in their totality. Now, your actual question was, at the state level, I'm tasked with evaluating systemic racism in all branches of state government. And what does that look like for policing? And, you know, truth be told, I think it could look very different depending on the community or depending on the time or depending on the generation that you ask. Mm-hmm. I have very strong personal sentiments that I wouldn't want to see our officers in schools. And that's largely due to the jurisdictions that I've lived in, the experiences that I've seen people have. But I've also heard other people say that, hey, we've done that in our community and it's worked really well. And I think when that works, it's great. And when it doesn't, it's a tragedy. And so thinking about what solutions are best for our region, our state, our communities, you may need a sort of braided solution where you have some degree of uniformity across local, county, and state level law enforcement, but then you also have customizations and tweaks that are unique to the community at hand. I think that's when you're really gonna get a sense of overarching consistency in the way people are treated while respecting the nuances of the different regions around the state. Consistency and uniformity is something that's been very important to me at the state level generally. And in policing, it's absolutely critical, right? If I get pulled over in the city of Townsville, Vermont, it shouldn't matter whether the officer is local, county, or state level. I should receive the same level of service, the same treatment, and the same outcomes in the same situation. And that's what's really critical. So having a baseline uniform system across all those levels is really key to building community trust and to having consistent outcomes for people. And then beyond that, I think those other tweaks are what make a community unique and what foster those community relations.
We are actually getting quite a few comments and questions related to the issue of school resource officers, including this one from Liz Curry of Burlington. She's a former Burlington School District school commissioner. She wants to know, how has the Burlington Police Department come to the conclusion that having officers in schools is beneficial? Has the Burlington Police Department surveyed and had focus groups with the families of Black and Brown students? How can a young Black youth reconcile the cognitive dissonance between seeing police kill Black men on TV and finding, quote, friendly police officers in their schools? How can they trust them? Why can't school resource officer functions be performed by restorative justice officers performing tier one relationships? Chief Murad, I think you might be the appropriate person to put that to first.
Sure, I don't want to necessarily take up the oxygen, but I will answer that. I would love to have some looks that involve focus groups, that involve outreach, because frankly, our understanding is anecdotal. It's strongly anecdotal in that we have lots of voices saying these things. I know the experiences that the officers had. I've seen it firsthand. I know that the CJC in Burlington feels that referrals are different when they come from SROs. I know that we see different results overall with regard to enforcement actions, et cetera. And we've seen decreases since the SROs implemented an MOU with the school several years ago. That has changed things. So you've got to have strong parameters on these. But to the extent that we want the community to be involved in those parameters and establishing them, absolutely. I think one of the other things there is the idea of, you know, could you replace school resource officers with some other kind of resource officer? And the answer is yes, with a but. Now, the but part is something that we thankfully in Vermont have not experienced, which is school shootings and violence in schools. And that is something that at least in Burlington, we have been fortunate not to have experienced. We have, however, had weapons brought to school. We have had incidents of violence in school to lower, much lower levels, but school resource officers are important to help reply to those. With regard to the concept of the other resource, a viable alternative, that goes to the much bigger question of this move to defund the police. And defunding the police is something, frankly, that most officers would embrace as long as it is done in a way that is sensible and is driven by data and experience and proof that alternative, viable resources for the roles that police currently have been saddled with over the past several decades, really, are actually able to be stood up so that they are efficacious and they are fair and they are really things that will continue to keep people safe. Because if you simply say that we are going to defund, slash, cut, fire officers and immediately turn that off without having built up the ancillary, parallel, viable means of addressing these other things, whether it's things in the schools or whether we're talking about other aspects, including dealing with mental health, dealing with social crises, going to families where, you know, where DCF is involved. If you haven't built up those things in a way that you can demonstrate it's there, it's strong, it's right, you will be putting public safety at risk.
Councillor Jiang, I know the issue of school resource officers is something you've been giving a lot of thought to lately. What are your thoughts on Liz's concerns about SROs?
Yes, I mean, I think I am in agreement with Acting Chief on this one, because I believe what we need is to provide some level of security in our schools. We all know what has happened to Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, and Columbine, just to mention a few, that in America we have a gun culture. And I don't wanna play lotteries here, knowing that I'm a parent, I have children going through the Burlington schools, and it would be imperative to think about some level of security there. And is it police officers that we need? It's a big question that we need to ask. But as we move forward, including both the parents, the children, as well as the staff in this conversation would be critical. But I think also it is important to mention, it is all about culture. And culture is what you do when no one is watching. I know some SROs who are outstanding, who no longer are SROs, such as Franco. DeFranco is an amazing police officer. And we have many great police officers. But what we want is for those people to keep on building relationship with the students, whether they're black or white, calling themselves in different sexual orientation. What we need for them is to be able to learn in a very safe and supportive environment. The police have the part to do, the teachers have a part to do, and also the community have a part to do. But this should be an ongoing conversation, but just taking them away from the schools right now, I don't think it is a feasible option as we speak.
Mia, I have a feeling that you might like to weigh in on this, right? We're hearing anecdotal evidence that SROs are working in schools. Your thoughts?
Well, I just wanted to just say that the school to prison pipeline, that's real, right? And to add into it, you know, these officers in uniform with their guns and everything, you know, that's just enforcing that, in my opinion. In terms of school shooting and safety, I don't see that those are mutually exclusive. Having a police officer at school is not going to necessarily prevent a shooting at the school. we have to mitigate it beforehand, like Shusana said. We have to mitigate it at the homes of people who are feeling the way that they feel in order to get to the point to shoot up a school. So it's like looking at it in a broad picture, not looking at it from where it starts and just looking at it from where it ends. And so we have to like move from that type of thinking, because as I said, the school to prison pipeline is very real, and I've seen it, and I'm sure that other people on this panel have seen it as well.
We'd like to bring in Stephanie Seguino now. Professor Seguino is a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. She's published 3 policy papers on traffic stop data in Vermont over the past 4 years. Her findings have helped drive conversations locally and at the state level about racial disparities in Vermont policing. Professor Seguino, you've been listening to the conversation thus far. In what way do you think the data that you've been looking at can help inform the conversation that we're trying to have right now?
Sure. I mean, I fundamentally believe that data is important, that anecdote is insufficient. And I want to speak to that with regard to the SRO issue. I think that it's really important for us to follow the research. And the research shows that when law enforcement is placed in schools, that kids do worse, and the impact on them is negative. And we have experience in Vermont with disproportionately kids of color being referred. One study, for example, shows that students are 3 times more likely to face arrests in schools with SROs than schools without SROs, and that the effect of being arrested in school has a negative impact on finishing high school and lifelong trauma. So I think we need to follow the science on this as well. And I want to second Liz Curry's comment, the cognitive dissonance of kids, not just across the country, but here in Burlington, we hear repeated reports of the police in Burlington stopping kids of color on the street to check them out, to say that they think that they're a suspect in some kind of burglary and so forth, and they feel targeted, and I think understandably so. And so their cognitive dissonance is that there is the school resource officer that may be a nice person, and I've met them, they are great, my son liked them a great deal, but their experience of kids on the street is very different, and the relationships that the SROs have built in the schools are not translating to the behavior of police on the streets with kids of color. So I think we really have to think about that. With regard to your other point in the data, I mean, data, you know, I think data are a way for us to look in the mirror. We're not always self-aware of what we do. And so data can help us see that there are patterns in our behaviors and help us understand what those are. And, you know, the data that we have for Vermont is that, especially in things like search rate disparities, so the probability of being searched is roughly 350% higher for African Americans than it is for white drivers, and it's around 270% higher for Hispanics. This was our study in 2017, and we're looking at subsequent data in 2017, 18, and 19 now, and we're finding that those disparities have not decreased across the state, and in some agencies have actually gotten worse. And so the data can tell us, is what we're doing enough? And the answer is not yet. It's not an easy problem to solve. Racist ideology and perspectives are deeply embedded to an extent we're not even aware of them. And we need to stay on this. And the data can help us understand where the problems are. And also, Chief Mara had said that they also can be, they most importantly should be used by police departments to be reflective about their behavior and to see, is implicit bias training working? Are these practices working? If not, what else do we do and go back to the drawing board? So I think that's an important part of moving forward.
Stephanie, could you speak a little bit more about implicit bias? Because we had a question about training for officers.
Right.
How do you mitigate against implicit bias?
Well, So a couple of things. I think one of my conversations with Chief Burke from Sean Burke from South Burlington is that that officers often don't have, and many people, I mean, I teach this at the university and my students come in with virtually no knowledge of racial history. And so they don't really understand the context in which they're operating. And that's, I think that's the first step. So implicit bias training, in addition to that kind of historical understanding of the role of race in our country, can help people become more self-aware of their behavior. And there is a lot of discussion. I heard a discussion the other day that implicit bias training doesn't work. I think that's overstated. Again, we have to get it right. But one of the things that we do know about implicit bias training is that it can help people become aware of their unconscious biases, make them conscious, so that in a moment when that implicit bias arises, they say, aha, that's what's going on. It's actually not what's in this situation, but my previous conditioning about the negative stereotypes that we have for people of color. And some of the research that I have found important and interesting says that implicit bias training should happen in small doses, but frequently. It's not like you do it once and it's over. And I think many police departments aren't really doing it that way. So I think it needs to be a regular part of the curriculum, if you will. But the other thing is that one of the things we've learned at hospitals, where there's also a great deal of racial discrimination, where Blacks are not given pain medication in COVID, they have been sent for testing less frequently than whites and so forth. And what we find is that if there is a drop-down menu, let's say for the doctor, and the doctor is, you know, writing their notes about somebody and they're thinking about some particular disease that needs pain medication, and there's a drop-down menu that says, did you know in this hospital that Black patients are less likely to be prescribed pain medication? It makes a person aware of their bias in the moment. It'd be very interesting to see drop-down menus in computers, in police cars, when the police are also making decisions. So, you know, we've got to solve this and we just have to keep at it. And these are some of the tools that I think are very important to do. And if we don't get it right the first time, we shouldn't give up. We should go back to the drawing board and try other modalities.
Susanna Davis, Joanne wrote in to ask about incarceration rates, which seems like a useful place to turn to, because it is in some ways the repository of the data and statistics we've been talking about today. Can you talk about what racial disparities in our correctional population look like in this state, and why we're seeing the disparity that we are?
Yes. So this is with the caveat that I can speak intelligently about this topic, but I'm not an expert on it. We recently went through a second round of what's called justice reinvestment in Vermont, which is an exercise where we looked at our corrections outcomes to determine whether and how to shift or reinvest money into preventative services, alternatives to incarceration, and other resources for people, either to reduce incarceration rates or to reduce recidivism rates or to boost successful parole and furlough rates. So, after the first round of justice reinvestment, which we did years ago, I believe we halved the prison the jail population here in Vermont. We did another round just recently and discovered that there were still modifications that we could make, particularly around the complexity of our furlough system. Vermont is one of the states that does have a furlough status in addition to being probation or parole or what have you. But we have a lot of furlough statuses and it creates confusion, it creates inconsistency, and we have a very high rate of people who have their community supervision, we'll call it, revoked. And that's where we see big disparities by racial groups, is in the revocation of community supervision, which includes things like furlough, parole, probation. So in Vermont, we do see racial disparity where Black Vermonters, or rather I should say Black people in Vermont, because Vermont has a lot of trouble with out-of-staters and the notion that that it's people from out of state who are coming into the state, bringing in drugs and contributing to our opioid epidemic. And the data do not show that. But that's the narrative that we're regularly told to justify our excessive traffic stops and unwarranted searches of people of color, particularly motorists of color who are driving out of state cars. That said, so Black people in Vermont who are incarcerated are disproportionately represented in the state's prison population. In 2017, Black Vermonters made up 1.6% of the state population, but over 11% of the jail population. Now that number has gone down. I believe now it's more like 8% of the jail population, but it's still incredibly disparate with respect to their representation of the state population. When we consider, and so one of the big takeaways while we're on the topic, one of the big takeaways that we learned from this exercise was the power of guidelines. It was discovered by our partners at the Council on State Governments that where Vermont had a sentencing guideline in place, judges tended to stick to those guidelines more often than not. There was a lot of consistency across racial groups and other categories. But where there were no guidelines, there was wild discretion, and that's where you saw bigger disparities between racial groups. So one of the things to consider, again, back to the topic of uniform policy, is how do we implement guidelines? And how do we implement uniform sentencing standards so that we can avoid having disparities between racial groups in the incarceration system here in Vermont?
We've got a question from Clara in Williston. She wants to know about department diversity, right? She's curious about the hiring and recruitment practices for Black and Indigenous and people of color in the police forces in Vermont. Who'd like to speak to that?
I can talk to that a little bit and say, frankly, that we're not doing a good enough job of it. It's definitely something that I would like to see improved here. But to the extent that our diversity is something that we're achieving, it's in our newer ranks. And frankly, it's in the exact officers who would be at risk by defunding measures. So the officers who most represent what it is that we're trying to establish the future of the profession, officers of color, officers with varied backgrounds, officers who represent LGBTQ communities. You know, we have disproportionate numbers of those officers in our youngest, it's not an age issue, but in our most recent hires over the past several years. And so I'm, you know, concerned about that. I'm concerned about continuing to attract people to the profession and concerned about the ability of recruitment, both with regard to resources and with regard to passion for the job. I'm very happy to say that the officers that we have in our most recent couple of years of hires are people who are tremendously dedicated to this job, and they represent a wide swath of our people and of the diversity that we're seeking. We don't have enough people who are Black and Indigenous, however, and that's something that we definitely need to look to. It's a challenge in this state. And what I would love to explore is the possibility of creating, especially in a place like Chittenden County, and more specifically in Burlington and Winooski too, some avenue whereby we reach out to communities of color, new American communities particularly, and find for them a means of saying, you know, how do we encourage you to come into this profession? If the profession is important, I believe that it is with all my bones. I've put my life into it and have turned away from the private sector into public service because I believe it's a calling. But if we believe it's that together, then we need to figure out a ways to make that calling represent the entirety of the community much more than it does today.
Mia Schultz, you've heard Sheriff Anderson talk about de-escalation training, verbal judo techniques to resolve some of the encounters that they're facing. We're hearing Chief Murad talk about the importance of having the roster of officers that they have right now. What do you think it is that they're missing right now as they assess their departments and look at what they're doing that you're seeing? What do you want them to begin to understand about the way you see them operating that you think needs to change?
I did want to, I'm glad, Peter, that you brought that to me, because I did want to comment on what Chair Vanderson had said about training and how, you know, they are increasing their levels of training and how, you know, they're trying to de-escalate situations and that sort of thing. In my mind, there are people who go to school to learn how people behave. And they go long periods of time to go to school. They get doctorate degrees in them. And I don't know the level of training for 6 weeks or 6 months even would be sufficient enough to be able to tackle some of that those issues in a sufficient way that would decrease the recidivism as Shusana and I are saying. So that's where my trouble lies, is that that you're not really social workers, you're not really psychologists or psychiatrists, you're not, or therapists, which takes level degree training, level, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's where I see it. And I'm having trouble getting past that because of the trauma that we have here, because of the bias that we have here in Bennington. We don't even, and I do want to say one other thing that I did appreciate on Chief Murad and Sheriff Anderson, that they do recognize that there's a problem. But that's not the case throughout the state of Vermont. In Bennington, they won't even acknowledge that there is a problem, that they won't even acknowledge that systemic racism exists in the department. And that includes the leadership of the town and the town in general, and the people in general who believe that racism doesn't exist because they don't walk in those shoes. So there's not gonna be an easy answer to this, but it will require people who think outside of boxes, who have degrees and doctorates in that area. And if that means that they consult with the police and they have them on staff and more than just one social worker, that's not gonna cut it. That's not gonna cut it. So, you know, so that's what we talk about when we talk about defunding, when we talk about reorganization. You know, we talk about really getting people who have dedicated their lives to human behavior and trauma. And so that's not gonna be a police officer who has 6 months of training. It's just not.
So are the problems that we're seeing across the nation and within our own state, are they due to lack of training? Is it an implicit bias issue? What accounts for the disparities? What accounts for the difference in treatment and in incarceration rates? And what is the problem?
White supremacy.
Hey, Mia? Someone else follow up?
Yeah. Could I add something there just really quickly? I want to note that the police officers in Atlanta who murdered Rayshard Brooks recently had been recently trained both in de-escalation and in use of force this year. So still fresh, top of the mind. So remembering that, I think it's really important to keep in mind that we cannot train away as something that is so inherent to all of our systems, social, economic, legal, et cetera. You can't train that away. And an academy of, you know, 10 weeks, 16, 20 weeks, 40 weeks is not going to be enough as a one-time shot to work against a lifetime of conditioning about the social order, right? It takes continuous work. It's slow work. It takes active thinking on a regular basis. I know that we tend to think of law enforcement officers as being in a class of their own, but they're actually human also. They're people alongside us. They shop in the same grocery stores. Their children attend the same schools that our children attend. And so to some extent, yes, they need training that's specific to their professions, but there's a certain, they also need the added social responsibility that everybody else needs too. I don't say that only white police officers in Vermont should be continually educated in bias. I think everybody should be continually educated in bias, and that our police should have an extra element of that due to the nature of the profession. But it's really important to keep that in mind. It's not about a lack of training, because the training happens. It's really about fundamental changes that have to happen and that can't be done overnight.
We got a question from an audience member. His name is Tony. He's an associate professor of law and criminal justice at Champlain College and the criminal justice program director. He asks, if defunding actually were implemented across the country on the model of maintaining the police but reallocating the budget, what would the new police officer's responsibilities look like? What is that officer doing? What is that officer not doing that they may be doing right now? What responsibilities fall away, and to whom do those responsibilities go? Anybody want to raise their hand to take a crack at that?
I'll just say a couple of things. I want to hear what Chief Murat has to say, but I think this is a new thing. We have to take the time to think this through. We don't have a model just sitting on the shelf. And so I really think that it's important for us to take the time to study, to look at what other countries do, what other agencies have done, and so on and so forth. You did ask the part of the question that didn't get cited was what kind of training should be included. And, you know, apart from the issue around race history, which is a serious problem, around gender inequality, which is one of our social problems, police officers in other countries like Norway literally take a year of psychology classes. And one of our major problems, because of the failure of our healthcare system, is mental health problems that lead to a lot of involvement. So I think those three areas certainly, and you know, in addition to some of the other things that have been discussed about de-escalation and so forth. But let me turn it over to Chief Merritt.
What falls away? That's a good question. And I'm really appreciative of hearing the professor say that we do want to consider these things pretty carefully before we undertake action on them. But what falls away could be things that we know are social service oriented and are social conditions rather than crime. I believe that the mission of police is to keep people safe by preventing and responding to crime and disorder with and for our neighbors. And there's a lot of stuff that is currently on the plate of the police that does not necessarily fall within those paradigms. However, many things that aren't necessarily police oriented are nevertheless, they contain a component of safety, and social services currently often won't go to certain kinds of calls without police, even if they are the better place to actually take the action and understand because of training, because of much longer histories with regard to education. But they still want police present for those moments because those moments can be very high risk and dangerous. So even as officers could conceivably withdraw from certain kinds of response if those viable alternatives are built up and exist, there's also going to be instances in which even those viable alternatives want police presence. So that's sort of our long answer. I mean, our short answer is, you know, we could start focusing on top type crime. In Burlington, we tier our jobs by call type. And the bulk are calls for service type one. And those are calls that really are 25,000 of our 30,000 calls would be from that particular type. They're not necessarily calls that have to have a police officer or even a police officer response, but they are things that are getting funneled into 911 because of years of that's how it's done. And 911 and dispatch gives it to us and officers go when they are called. But some of those could be diminished. Frankly, some would be diminished in a world in which we drastically were to reduce headcount. But then we have our other types of calls, the type three call, which are those are the big ones. Those are robbery, those are domestic violence calls, those are things that are serious crimes and need immediate response. We're very fortunate as a culture, and particularly as a city here in Burlington, but that's not a huge percentage of it. It's about 1,500. And then you've got, you know, 5,000 to 9,000 in any given year of these type two calls. And those were trending down, but they're trending up recently. And they have to do with disorder. They have to do with disturbance calls and disorderly conduct and different kinds of conditions that are sometimes criminal, sometimes not, but are disturbances that result in disorder and people's quality of life being diminished. Those are things that officers are still going to have to respond to. So we've given some thought about where our thresholds are, and we're eager to understand whether or not there are things that can help us not have to take on as much as we've been asked to take on as a profession over the past several decades. But it really has to be done in a way that's forward thinking, that is driven by proof and evidence, and isn't just done in a very, very passionate moment, because people wearing a uniform that looks not unlike this one murdered a man in Minneapolis.
Councillor Jing, I want to make sure we bring you in this as well.
Thank you. And I think, you know, when the police received a call from a community member, I think before even it's forwarded to the police, it has to go somewhere first, like 911, you know? But I think even those people need to have some level of training. I mean, I think thinking about policing in the 21st century, we need to move away from 911 and then it's a police. Yeah. Sometimes it is imperative to provide safety by not having the police respond. And I think most importantly, sometimes we can send a call, but we know this is appropriate for only Howard Center to send the staff to respond to this specific situation. I think also it is imperative, just like the army, people are specialized in many different areas. You know, I think the police training need to start to think about those type of training for their officers. How about sending people who have training around just working with people with some mental health issues? Why should we send the police? Do we need to create another agency that only respond and also know people who experience homelessness and know the situation that they really lived in? The problem that we encounter, all of us, is the police, they all receive the same type of training, and none of those trainings are very specific to the amount of call or the nature of the call that they receive. I think we need to start to think about it that way, but we cannot also implement just defunding the police bump. No. It requires a process that's very thoughtful, methodical, research, and that includes the community members that we need.
Could I add one thing here? You know, there's a lot, there's so much we haven't said in this conversation that should be said, but one of the things that I feel we have to say is that we have, this whole time we've been talking about police responding to calls, without acknowledging, under the assumption that people calling the police are using that service responsibly. And so this is your weekly PSA to people to stop calling the cops on Black, Latino, Asian, Indigenous people for ridiculous reasons. Do not weaponize the state against others. If you have an annoyance, don't make it a problem. If you have a problem, handle it like a grown-up. And if you have something that is trivial, that does not need a response from law enforcement, if we know that there could be the risk that the person won't survive that encounter, then effectively you're signing a death warrant when you call the cops because a person is, let's check the list, sleeping or reading or, you know, sunbathing. So again, it's not just about the responsibility of police to behave responsibly when they respond to a call, but it's also about the responsibility of individuals, members of the public, not to misuse that service. It's a waste of tax dollars, it's a waste of resources, and it's too often a tragedy that doesn't need to happen.
Can I just speak to that real quick?
Please.
Everything she just said is, if we could say it 100 times and just keep playing that on the radio, that would be wonderful. If you call my dispatch, and I assume it's the same for Burlington PD, and I know it's the same in many agencies, so I can't speak for all of them, but if you call my dispatch and report a person of color as being a suspicious person, and you don't give anything that describes a suspicious person, we're going to tell you this is not an appropriate call. We're not responding to that. A person walking down the street is a person walking down the street. It's not what you look like. It's what you're doing. That we consider when we consider a suspicious call. So we are frustrated when we receive malicious 911 phone calls. We are frustrated when we see phone calls where people are weaponizing the police. And it's just not acceptable. People need to stop that. We we are doing what we can to stop that from our end. I just really appreciate that she said that.
That's great.
Can I speak to safety really quick, to the term safety? Because what safety looks like to me is not police. I don't call police when I feel in danger, because that doesn't end up always in a good spot for us. Even when, and that's actually exemplified by what has happened here in Bennington with our Black legislator, Kaya Morris. She didn't get protection from the Bennington police, right? That was international news. And so I know that in communities of color, that calling the police does not always equal safety. And I just want to put that out there. So,
Councilor Jang.
And I think the question, the original question was about, you know, what type of policing we're talking about here, and how it's going to look like, defunding the police and all of that. But one point also to point out in terms of discrepancies that happen is sometimes even Black people, and this I experienced it twice, me calling the police and they're not responding. It has happened, and it was not before Del Paso. One time, the second time I called the police, they never ever respond to my call, because maybe of how I sound, my accent. And I ended up getting what I needed, because I was in a meeting with a deputy, with a chief back then, and who just get it to me like this. I think we need to also just thinking about policing, calling and receiving the appropriate response needed differently. We live now in a different time. And what we should be striving for is basically solution. And to the question previously, why we don't have people from different socioeconomic background becoming police officers, we need to also move away from just we tried, but let's just make this happen. As an elected official since 2017, I've been striving and requesting for that to happen, but we haven't got anywhere. But also, let's not also forget the retention piece, because in Burlington, we used to have a couple of Black police officers. I don't know why they gone. I think it's important also to think about how do we retain them once we hire them in the force. Thank you.
There's a question from Jean. She says that there was something that Acting Chief Murad mentioned that made her think about the problem of police unions, right? How do we usher out tired officers who might benefit from finding another job or a new career? How do we replace them with individuals who may be more broadly trained and who might have a deeper understanding of issues of racism? So at the core of the question, how do we get rid of the bad and keep the good?
Chief Murad, I'm gonna nominate you.
And I was actually trying not to speak. I feel like I've spoken a little too much, and I wanted to make certain everybody's being heard. So I'll keep it brief. I mean, how do we do that? It's not as simple as saying, how do you remove the one? It's also talking about how do you find the other? They're intertwined. You know, police officers, like any other workforce, are entitled to union protections. I believe that. I believe in unions. I've been a member of, I think, 6 unions over the course of my life, and I believe in them. So people are entitled to those kinds of protections. How do we work with them and actually make certain that everybody's needs are being served, both the individual member of a union and the community that they serve, or the city they serve? You know, that's through collective bargaining processes and having invested members of the community or the administration really inject these kinds of requests into that process. But the second part of that is, in many ways, to my mind, the more important one. It's how do we attract the right kind of talent to it? You know, our application to hire rate is about 4.5%. So about 4.5 make it through that process. And then a lot of them don't make it through the academy. And then, as the council member pointed out, some get through the academy and come into the department and then don't stay. And we can look at specific reasons. In a department the size of Burlington, you can really find individual reasons. This one moved because his wife was a surgeon and she went off to Philadelphia, so he went to Philadelphia with her. This person went to Maryland because there was family in Maryland, and maybe Vermont was too darn cold. But how do you keep that? That's a challenge for us too. I don't have quick answers to that. The fact is that up until this moment that we are in right now, where 400 years have come crashing down again, because it's happened before and we haven't seen the movement that people want forward. But up until this moment, the biggest threat facing the policing profession was the hidden time bomb of recruitment and retention. And it was being felt by agencies across the country. And it's driven by a lot of things. It's driven by either more lucrative professions. It's driven by generational differences, where people don't necessarily want to have a career for 20 years, and yet the career is structured in that way, driving towards pensions, the amount of training that goes into it before you can even really start. There are a number of those factors. And so, you know, there are possible answers for some of them, but they're oftentimes resource intensive.
Can I make a comment? Yeah, so I too am a union member at the university and have been a long time member and fully support unions. But I want us to think about this. If we had a pilot who was negligent and behaved poorly and put people's lives in danger, would we find a way to exit that person? Would we allow a surgeon who engages in malfeasance in terms of his or her medical career, would we find a way to exit them? So I think it's hard, and I think we have to think about that. I want to go to the issue that the chief mentioned also about finding the right talent. You know, when I talk to people of color in terms of hiring issues, they say they want to go to a place that is welcoming. And so if you have police officers who are in fact racially biased, you are going to find that you're not going to be able to hire officers of color, because that's not a safe environment for them. So this is a complex system. There are so many different pieces here that we have to figure out. But fundamentally, I think that the death of George Floyd tells us we have to figure them out. We can't let current union contracts stand in the way of the safety of a significant portion of our population. We have to work it through. And I'm hopeful that with the protests that have happened, that we will find that there is a willingness to renegotiate union contracts, and that police officers will stand behind their condemnation of Minneapolis and say, you know, you're right, we have to engage in supporting our members, but we also have to support the community in making sure that those who are hurting the community are no longer on the force.
From VPR, I'm Lydia Brown. Today, we're listening back to a community conversation produced in partnership with Vermont PBS. We have to take a break, but when we come back, our panelists share their final thoughts on issues of race and policing in Vermont. Where does the conversation go from here? That's next.
We're running low on time, but I want to close by getting some concluding thoughts from everybody. But Susana Davis, I want to start with you. You said there are so many issues that need to be addressed that we have not yet. What's missing from conversations that we're having right now about race and policing that we need to make sure we do include?
More voices, honestly, more voices. More voices from people in different age groups, more voices from people who are from Vermont, who aren't from Vermont. I especially would love to hear from people who left Vermont based on why they left Vermont. I think that's what's missing, honestly. I mean, we have a lot of capable and intelligent members of law enforcement here who spend careers talking about this kind of stuff, and it's great to hear from them from their perspective. But, you know, it's not in a vacuum, right? Every corner of our community, let's bring kids in next time and ask them, how do you feel about cops in schools? Let's bring people who used to live in the state in and say, hey, why'd you leave? Did this have anything to do with it? So yeah, that's I think what I think primarily is missing. And that includes language access and being able not only to have these conversations with more people, but being able to have it with people in the languages they speak.
Great. Maybe we can get some final thoughts from all of our panelists. We're where do we go from here? What do you want our audience members to take with them from this conversation and maybe think about?
Yes, if I may.
Yes. Yep,
I think the question to be asked is, why do we even hear? Why do we even have this conversation right now? And why thousands of people showed up at Burlington City Council to speak about defending the police? Why? Could we have prevented this in Burlington when we had the opportunities? And I think opportunities are still here. One of them is, for example, the mural in downtown Burlington. When we talk about race, diversity, equity, inclusion, keeping it there is still promoting that Black people, Black lives don't matter. That white supremacy is what we need to strive for. We had the opportunity, let's take it off, move on. And again, in specific to the police, why we got here and why people are so fed up is just because of the lack of transparency from our elected officials around some behaviors from police officers that took place here. Why do we hold on to information? Why do we hide? Why are we not transparent? I think striving for justice, striving for equity, accountability is something we need to keep on doing, whether or not we defund the police, whether or not we reduce or retain some police officers. That's my message, and let's continue to make sure we have people that really care about the well-being of everyone here in Burlington and in the state of Vermont. Thank you for having us.
Sheriff?
I'm sorry, was that for me?
Yes.
The audio cracked up. So I could give you a very long list in this answer, and I'm going to be somewhat short. Data. We need consistent, reliable data. We need more data. We need to be listening to our communities. We need to be opening our doors. I haven't walked a step in a person of color shoes. I don't know it, and that's why I'm trying to seek people of color out. We need trust. I speak for many of the chiefs and sheriffs in saying, we recognize that we need to do that. And there might be ones that have violated it directly. Those are things that we need to also come to terms with and recognizing what the path forward is. This is a complex issue. It's not just the criminal justice system or the police, though that is the topic for tonight. This is society that we're trying to fix. And understanding that we need to look at this as a holistic solution and trying to fix this segmentation of the problems, I think is a really important need and mission that we need to undertake.
Okay.
Chief Murad?
I think that the takeaway for me is that this is a moment of tremendous opportunity, and there should be a lot of optimism about this moment. This is something that has beleaguered this nation since its origins. It is a stain on the country's soul. It's been here since the first people landed and came to a place that was already occupied and lived in by others. I think that it is something that is ours to set right if we are able to really focus on it, to talk about these things in ways that expand beyond just nibbling at the edges, but really talk about how we change systems. I don't believe that you can change systems wholesale overnight and snap fingers and make it happen, but I think you can envision the idea of it. As long as that vision is driven by the concept of human dignity, that everyone has value, that we are in this together, that we're neighbors, and that we are trying to pull in the same direction, and that everyone will be safe as they do that. And I take to heart what Mia said about, you know, how some people consider X safe or Y safe, but ultimately the concept of wanting a life that is safe and is free from harm, and that you can enjoy the shared spaces that communities thrive on, especially in this amazing state, is really important. And I think that we're in a place where we can start thinking about how to make that happen in intelligent ways that ultimately benefit everyone.
Absolutely. Stephanie?
this is, as Chief Merritt said, this is a particular moment in history. What I really hope is that people who identify as white and the police departments in this state let go of being defensive and listen to the devastation of the lives of people of color. And it's a good time for those of us who identify as white to be quiet and listen. I would also say, I just got an email from a viewer here about a Minneapolis report on their police department. There's a lot of learning to do from what other agencies are doing. There are some that are very progressive, have some innovative ideas. This is really a time to be courageous and bold and not to hang on to the past, because the past gave us George Floyd and many others.
And Mia Schultz, last word goes to you tonight.
Thank you. Well, I think believing, number one, acknowledging and believing, believing that there's a problem. That's number one. And then listening, of course, but not listening and then saying, oh, I have a better way of doing things. I think that you're wrong and I think I can change it around. Listening and acting on the requests of people, of BIPOC people, which goes to believing them, right? And to going slow and taking time, I understand we have to do things in measured response, but I want people to remember that people are dying. Like, we can't keep saying we have to go slow. People are dying. And to recognize that and be swift and listen and make sure that you're breaking down the systems from the top down. I love Vermont. I just been here for 5 years. It's the most beautiful state. And we don't have a big population. We have so many opportunities to make change here. And we can do it if we all listen to each other. And I think that that's key to everything.
From VPR, I'm Lydia Brown. This community conversation was recorded earlier this month in collaboration with Vermont PBS. Special thanks to our hosts, St. Michael's College professor Tracy Griffith and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. And thanks to our panelists, Mia Schultz, a Bennington resident who serves as vice chair of the Bennington Town Democratic Party and as a member of the Vermont Ethnic Studies Coalition, Susanna Davis, executive director of racial equity for Vermont, John Murad, acting chief of police for the Burlington Police Department, Ali Jang, Burlington City Councilor for Ward 7, Mark Anderson, sheriff for Windham County, and a representative of the Vermont Sheriff's Association, and Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont. We had production, engineering, and marketing support from Anna St. Marie, Michelle Owens, Frank Allwine, Anna Post, David Rice, David Littlefield, Amy Zielinski, Brian Stevenson, Belinda Lott, Scott McMillan, Kaylee Mumford, and Kyle Blair. Thanks also to Sarah Ashworth, Scott Finn, and Jack Ephraimson. You can find more information about this program at vpr.org. And as always, thanks for listening.